This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the Yemeni army making further advances towards liberating Oil-rich Maghreb by capturing yet another strategic region from Saudi-backed militants. Iran voices concern about the rise of Daesh and other Takfiri terror groups in Afghanistan as a fresh spate of deadly violence grips the nation. Plus, Venezuela is outraged at the extradition to the U.S. of a close aide to President Maduro, with the government saying it will not attend weekend talks with the opposition. Hello, and welcome to your world news. Come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: the Yemeni army and its allied forces are moving closer to fully liberating Maghreb province. They have just captured a new strategic region. The Ansarullah movement says the military and popular groups had retaken Al-Abdiyah district from forces affiliated with former Saudi-backed President Abdurrabbah Mansour Hadi. With this advancement, Yemeni forces now have only two more of the 14 districts left to liberate. Ansarullah says Washington's call for a halt to fighting and the opening of a safe passage for militants clearly indicates that Washington is linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh operatives. The call comes just as the movement is inching closer to the final victory in the battle for Maghreb. It says U.S. officials are advocating for peace, but they are the real enemies of peace in Yemen and elsewhere. Iran's foreign minister has expressed concern about the rise of Daesh and other Takfiri groups in Afghanistan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark during a meeting with Peter Olonsky, Austria's Secretary General for Foreign Affairs, in the Federal Ministry for European and International Affairs. Iran's top diplomat called on the European Union to adopt a more responsible approach toward the rights of displaced Afghan people. The Austrian official condemned the latest terror attack in Afghanistan, adding that Tehran and Vienna have shared concerns about Daesh in the Central Asian country. Tens of Afghans have been killed and many others injured after three blasts rocked a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's southern city of Kandahar. The blasts came just 1 week after a terrorist attack on Shia worshippers in the northern city of Kunduz left at least 50 people dead. Our correspondent, Rahmatullah Bakhwan, has more from Kabul.
Kandahar mosque blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack claimed by a Daesh terrorist group.
I think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity. They kill hundreds without being held accountable. The perpetrators are Takfiri terrorist groups and the enemies of Afghanistan and Islam. Taliban, as a new ruler, should maintain security, not only for their officials, but also for citizens.
Recent bomb attacks that targeted our innocent people have no place in Islam. They are misusing Islam's name. The government should take decisive measures and bring those responsible to justice.
Observers see the attacks as part of a larger plot to sow seditions between Muslim brothers in Afghanistan. They add that there are hands-off intelligence agencies and countries behind these divisive plots.
Being defeated in Iraq and Syria, the Daesh terrorist group is taking revenge on Afghan Shias. Also, the U.S. is seeking revenge for its defeat in Afghanistan.
Kandahar attacks comes in line of a series of attacks targeting the unity of Afghan Muslims. Moreover, the most important point about these attacks is that the U.S. is trying to create tensions in the region to involve Iran, India, and Russia in an unwanted war.
The Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council condemned the attack and urged the Taliban government to take action against Daesh and fulfill their promises. Shia clerics called for further unity and solidarity among all Muslims.
The recent deadly bomb blasts have caused a wave of shock among Afghans, especially in big cities. Many here say they now expect the Taliban to put an end to the terror attacks by Daesh and establish security in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israeli forces have assassinated a former Syrian parliament member who had spent years in the regime's jails. According to Syrian media, Medhad al-Saleh was killed in the village of Ain al-Tina when Israeli snipers targeted him on his way home. The Syrian village is near the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian government condemned the killing as, quote, a cowardly criminal act. It says Saleh had spent 12 years in prison in Israel. He was jailed in 1985 for what Tel Aviv called resistance to Israeli authorities. Iraq's Electoral Commission says the turnout in the country's parliamentary election held last Sunday was 43%. The commission said more than 9.6 million people cast their ballots in the October 10 vote. The figure is lower than the last voting that took place in 2018. The party led by influential cleric Muqtada Assad came first and won 73 seats. Several Iraqi factions, including the Fatah Alliance, dismissed the results as fabricated. A total of 329 seats were up for grabs in the election. More than 3,240 candidates were vying for the seats. China has reportedly tested a new space capability with a hypersonic missile amid tensions with the U.S. over a string of issues. A Financial Times report says Beijing launched a nuclear-capable missile in August that circled the Earth at low orbit before descending toward its target. The report said the hypersonic glide vehicle was carried by a Long March rocket. The report added China's progress on hypersonic weapons has caught U.S. intelligence by surprise. Hypersonic missiles can fly at more than five times the speed of sound. They are also hard to track and defend against. The development comes as Beijing and Washington are at loggerheads over a number of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Venezuela's negotiations with the opposition heading for a possible deadlock, with the government now saying it will not attend the weekend talks in Mexico. That came in reaction to Cape Verde extraditing a close aide to President Nicolas Maduro to the U.S. Caracas accuses Washington of kidnapping diplomatic envoys and says the suspension is in protest against the brutal aggression against its delegate. The government has been holding negotiations with the opposition to resolve a long-running political crisis. Alex Saab was appointed a member of that negotiating team, but he was detained in Cape Verde in 2020 on a U.S. arrest warrant. Saab blames political motives for the money laundering charges against him. Yellow Vest protesters are back on the streets of France months after their protests died down due to COVID-19. The demonstrators are again venting anger at the government's economic policies they blame for the hardships they're facing. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that with our guests. Let's take a listen.
And now it's time for this edition of the news review. In this edition, Yellow Vest protesters have staged demonstrations across France to reject their government's economic policies. Protests were held at least in 300 French cities and towns, including the capital, Paris. Protesters, among other things, are angry at high diesel prices. They say the prices have continued to increase since the late 2018. That is when the Yellow Vest demonstrations first began in France, posing a big challenge to the government of President Emmanuel Macron. Since taking office, Macron has been pushing for reforms he says are necessary for economic progress, but ordinary people say his policies have put pressure on them. The Yellow Vests have returned to the streets after their protests died down in the past months due to COVID-19. Now, for more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Ramin Mazahiri, who is with us live from Paris, and also Paolo Raffone, co-founder and CEO of the CIPI Foundation, live from Brussels. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with our correspondent Ramin Mazahiri. If you could please tell us more about this new season, as you described, of the Yellow Vest movement.
Yes, France's most repressed political group, the Yellow Vests, they have just premiered what they are calling Season 2. As you mentioned, it was over 300 cities and towns planned to have demonstrations. And it's the first time that they've demonstrated in more than a year and a half due to coronavirus restrictions. They actually began, it was almost 3 years ago, they first put out which are reflective gear that are required to have in your car here in France, and they were in response to regressive fuel tax hikes amid diesel gas price records. Well, energy costs, including diesel, just hit records again, and the Yellow Vests are back on the street. You know, the Yellow Vests were essentially the biggest class-based political movement in the West in the 21st century. But they were also incredibly popular. Here in France, they always had a approval rating around 60%, and they inspired international emulation. Some 30 countries started their own Yellow Vest movement. That's even though they were falsely smeared with charges of xenophobia. They held marches against anti-Semitism, and at the march today in Paris, their leading banner was of a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. I think many people will remember how President Macron's hardline policies provoked international condemnation, because from November 2018 until about June 2019, every Saturday in Paris was just a war zone, and the world was shocked. They were just shocked at French-style democracy, which uses indiscriminate tear gas. It attacks peaceful protesters with rubber bullets and violence, all while still claiming to be this beacon of political and human rights. The Yellow Vest list of demands are, you know, basically a call to rethink all of France's major political policies, everything from leaving the European Union and the Eurozone and NATO to redistribution of wealth to green energy policies. What they want is open public debate and referendums on these basic issues. I would say that they're calling for a cultural revolution, basically. So to sum up, they are going to keep marching, they said, every Saturday until at least France's election in April. And that could be a major black eye for President Emmanuel Macron.
Exactly. And that's the question I would like to address Mr. Raffone with. Do you believe, how could this affect Macron's popularity? Do you think he will have any policies to in somehow, let's say, bring these people back to the voting polls in order to vote for him?
Well, I do not think that he will even attempt to try to have these people vote for him. This is out of question. They will never do it. What he can try to do is to reduce the effect of the protest, maybe promising some kind of appeasement measures. However, for the time being, I mean, the protest is important because it resurged after a long time, but it has not caused a major impact yet in the country. We have to see if it will evolve in further protests in the next weeks. Certainly, it's a signal to Macron's policies, reminding him that the mood of a significant part of the population is not in his favor. And the turmoil at political level in France is quite big, because, as you know, there are still several candidates competing on the right side to Macron, and there is one specific candidate, or better, future to be candidate. He still didn't disclose his candidature, which is Mr. Zemmour, who may be a joker in the game for the presidential elections. So France is entering now a very unquiet time that may evolve also to towards further demonstrations and even confrontation with the current administration and president.
Thank you very much, Mr. Paolo Raffone, co-founder and CEO of the CIPI Foundation, live from Brussels, and also our very own Ramin Mazahari, who has been covering these Yellow Vest protests from the beginning, live from Paris. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review.
Now, a piece of advice from Algeria's president for French leaders. Paris must put aside any colonialist thought when dealing with historical issues related to his country. And a message marking the 1961 killings of Algerian protesters by Paris police, Abdelmadjid Tebboune says historical issues should be treated with a sense of responsibility. He says massacres and crimes against humanity will remain in collective memory. Emmanuel Macron has become the first French president to recognize the crimes committed that day without, however, offering a formal apology. Some anti-racism groups are welcoming Macron's stance, but say it is not enough. Back in October 1961, Algerians in Paris organized a march against a night curfew. Hundreds are believed to have lost their lives after French police turned on the demonstrators. The United States military established its Africa Command 13 years ago. The aim was expanding America's military footprint on the continent. But what will an increased presence of U.S. forces mean for Africa? Asensaria reports from South Africa's Cape Town.
From once having no strategic military interest in the continent, within just over a decade, the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. The Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, project describes itself as designed to promote regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen security forces of allied nations. But it also admits that AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Some analysts are pointing to a spike in coup attempts in areas that have the largest concentration of U.S. bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. A growing rivalry with China is also cited as a reason for the West's military project, aimed at dominating the African continent and exploiting resource-rich nations here. Back in 2008, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed willingness to host American bases. But now even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the U.S. The USS Herschel Williams is the first warship permanently assigned to AFRICOM. It is also the second time that it is docking here in Cape Town in less than a year. The expansion of AFRICOM indicates the strategic military ties and influence that the U.S. hopes to establish with South Africa. In this case, the future looks dim for Africa. As history indicates, the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to any region it has established a military foothold. Hassan City, Cape Town.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Tell a little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student in first to say. My dad, who is from India,
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, October 17th, 2021. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English Radio programs. If you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, then record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, your program, dear listeners. As usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you may know, these reception reports are very useful and important to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports, as you may know, enable us to provide a better service, a high-quality service, to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us in the time of pandemic. Here, I do appreciate those of our dear listeners who have sent us reception reports, including N. Arun Kumar from India, who is one of our regular listeners, Sixten Niman from Finland, who is also one of our regular listeners, and Vlad Vinograd from Russia, one of our old and regular listeners. And Arun Kumar, Sixten Niman, and Vlad Vinograd, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. Many thanks for sending us these reception reports. And here, I read the names of our dear listeners who have sent us emails from around the world, and later during the program I will read their emails. First of all, we have an email from N. Arun Kumar from India. Toshio Shibata, one of our regular listeners, has sent us an email from New Zealand. We have an email from Nicholas Lynch and Jan Thornblom from Sweden, one of our regular listeners, has sent us an email. And the last but not the least is an email from Pastorino Gianni from Italy, who is one of our regular listeners. Please stay with us until the end of the program. I will read these great emails from around the world. Welcome back. First of all, we have an email from N. Arun Kumar from India. N. Arun Kumar, one of our regular listeners, says, "Dear Sir or Madam at IRIB English Radio, I thought this reception report enclosed to this email might be helpful for you. Unfortunately, there was a lot of noise in the broadcast. I hope it will be fixed very soon. I will be happy if you can please verify the report and send the QSL card with the program guides, pens, stickers to my address. Salam and warm greetings to you and Arun Kumar from India, and many thanks for sending us this email. And of course, thank you for sending us the reception report. Of course, the reception report you sent to IRIB English Radio is very helpful and useful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. My colleagues will soon send you an eQSL card, because in the time of pandemic, sending QSL cards, paper QSL cards, and the items you requested, including program guides, patents, stickers, is not possible at the time of pandemic. So you can find the program guide or program schedule in our website at www.parstoday.com/yen. Anyway, it was a pleasure to have you with us in this program. Write to us soon, and Arun Kumar from India, and tell us your views about IRB English radio programs. And from Japan, we have an email from one of our old and regular listeners, and that is an email from Toshio Shibata from Japan. Toshio Shibata says, "Hello. Further to my report 2 weeks ago, I am re-reporting a reception of IRIB World Service. This time, I was able to listen to the broadcast much longer at a better condition. I attached an MP3 recording. I hope you will recognize the voice of a speaking colleague. Could you please send me an eQSL indicating my reception? Thank you in advance for your kind understanding. Best regards." Hello. Warm greetings to you, Toshio Shibata from Japan. I do appreciate you for sending us this email. And, of course, my colleagues will soon send you an eQSL for verify your reception. And we received your MP3 recording. Thank you for that, for the MP3 recording. So you listened to the broadcast much longer at a better condition, and it's great. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRB English radio programs. Toshio Shibata from Japan. And now, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails, and this time from New Zealand. Welcome back from New Zealand, from the Southern Hemisphere. We have an email from Nicholas Lynch. Nicholas Lynch from New Zealand says, "Hello, my name is Nicholas Lynch from Christchurch, New Zealand. I would like to present you with a signal report for the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Please find attached a recording I made, broadcast received UTC, that is 419 to 450 here in New Zealand. Signal was strong and clear. Thank you for great programs. Kind regards." Salam and warm greetings to you, Nicholas Lynch, from New Zealand, from Southern Hemisphere. So you are from Christchurch, New Zealand. Thank you for telling us. And I think it's spring in the Southern Hemisphere. We in Iran are located in Northern Hemisphere, and it's for the countries that are located in the Northern Hemisphere, it's autumn. But I think the countries in the Southern Hemisphere, they are experiencing a spring, so the weather is great. As well, in Iran, it's autumn, and the weather is amazing. You can't believe it. So, we're very happy that our signals are received in Christchurch, New Zealand. That's great. So, it seems that you enjoy the programs and the quality of the programs. As you said, the signal was strong and clear, and we had great programs. That's great. Many thanks for sending us this email, Nicholas Lynch from New Zealand. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. Wait for an eQSL from IRIB English radio. And also from Sweden, we have an email from Jan Thornblom, who is one of our regular listeners. Jan says, "Dear staff of IRIB English radio, As my hobby is listening to distant radio stations, I was very pleased to hear your station. The signal strength was quite okay, but a little unstable with some atmospheric noise and interference from a transmitter. Thank you very much for your nice program. I hope you can identify your program through this detail. If you found my report correct, I should be very glad to receive your QSL card, a letter, or an email as a verification that I really have been listening to your nice and interesting station. I am 83 years old. I am living in central part of Malmo, which is a city with about 345,000 inhabitants, located in the province Skåne, in southern part of Sweden, and only 30 kilometers east of the capital city of Denmark, Copenhagen. I hope to hear from you soon. Best greetings. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Jan Thornblom from Sweden, and we send you our warm gratitude for sending us this great email. Thank you for reflecting your views about IRB English radio programs and its quality, and thank you for sharing your information, the place you live. You said you live in central part of Malmo, which is 30 kilometers east of the capital city of Denmark, Copenhagen. That's great. So you mentioned that your hobby is listening to distant radio stations. And that's good. Please tell us which program or programs in IRB English Radio you like the best. Because you said you enjoy the programs and you found them interesting. So tell us your opinion about these programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And you had some trouble with atmospheric noise, as you said, with the interference from transmitter. We will inform our technicians and engineers about the problems you mentioned. So please tell us more about these problems in the near future, if there was any problem, and then we can fix it. Write to us soon, Jan Thornblom from Sweden. And we're looking forward from hearing from you. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. Wait for one of them. And now, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with an email from Italy. Welcome back. This email is from Italy, from Pastorino Gianni. Pastorino Gianni is one of our regular listeners, but we haven't heard from him for a long time. Pastorino says, greetings from Andorra, Italy. I am receiving with great pleasure your programs. I would be happy to receive your QSL card. Thank you in advance and best regards. Ciao, salam. Greetings to you, Pastorino Gianni from Italy. Thank you for writing to us. Yes, we haven't heard from you for a long time. Write to us soon. And wait for an EQSL card, because sending paper QSL cards in the time of pandemic is not possible. So you have received different programs from IRB English Radio. Please let this relationship continue. Write to us soon and tell us your views about the programs you had from IRIB English Radio. Thank you. wishing you all the best in life, of course. Wishing you safety and health in the time of pandemic. We wrap up this week's edition of Listen to the Special. Please keep in touch with us and have a good time.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Now, in this edition, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has reaffirmed a U.S. position on Syria as to oppose the country's reconstruction and also not to support any attempts at normalization with the government of Bashar al-Assad. However, more and more Arab countries are accepting that Assad isn't going anywhere and they have taken steps to normalize their ties with Syria. This includes Jordan, which opened its border with Syria in September. Tonight, we are putting the spotlight on how the equations are changing in the Arab world and discuss the U.S. policy towards Syria. Let's begin with our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, for more on that. Thank you very much, Muhammad Ali.
Yes, there is a clear shift in the policies of various Arab countries towards Syria if we see what has been happening in the past couple of months. Of course, first, Jordan opened its border crossing with Syria. We witnessed for the first time the visit of officials from the Syrian government, ministers visiting Jordan and agreeing on boosting economic cooperation. We also witnessed the visit of, for the first time in, since the crisis started in Syria, the visit of also several ministers from Lebanon, and they held meetings with the Syrian government for economic cooperation. We also witnessed many other important meetings. All those meetings and indications show that there is a shift in the policies of those Arab countries towards Syria, a realization perhaps that Syria is strong. The Syrian president was stronger than the plots carried out and made by the United States and its Western allies. We also have to point out what Syria's foreign minister Faisal Maqdad said in the past month. He said that Syria is working on attracting huge investments from the Arab world. He also met for the first time since the start of the crisis when he was in New York attending the UN General Assembly conference. He met with the foreign ministers of over 9 Arab countries. All of those indicate that, yes, definitely we are witnessing a shift in the attitude of those Arab countries towards Syria and realization that Syria has been capable to overcome all of those difficulties, the plots, the terrorism, and that all the means and ways used by those countries, the United States and its Western allies, to topple the Syrian government, to destroy the country, was not working. And Syria is actually getting stronger and stronger with the support of its people and with the help of its allies.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Mohammad Ali, there from Damascus. Now, to continue this discussion, we're joined by a journalist and political analyst, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, who is joining us from London, and also independent researcher and writer, Janice Portman. Let's begin with Hafsa. Now, it seems that Arab leaders, particularly the allies of the United States, are coming to terms with the fact that Bashar Assad retains a solid grip on power, and they are trying to revive their economic and diplomatic ties with Syria. Why do you think these countries have decided to take a different course?
Well, essentially because Assad has won the war and managed to retain the integrity of Syria, proving his detractors wrong, and obviously proving that his insistence to remain at the helm was the good and wisest decision and actually saved Syria. It's also a recognition, I think, one of the few times where the respect of public opinion, because in the case of the Arab world, I think you'll find that the peoples of the of most Arab countries were actually opposed to the interventions against Syria, whereas many leaderships actually supported it. So it's also now an alignment between public opinion and leadership. And finally, of course, it's realpolitik. It's the idea that this is a very important country within the Arab world, and that now that Assad has proven that he is going nowhere, business has to resume back to normal.
Let's bring in Janice Kortkamp from Leesburg. Now, Janice, what does the growing interest in the Arab world in reconciliation with Syria say about the destabilization project that began back in 2011 with the participation of the U.S. and its NATO allies, as well as regional allies like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and Turkey?
Well, it's very interesting and kind of hard to say at this point. I think the steps that have been taken recently are very hopeful. You know, the steps like Interpol working once again with Syria, Jordan reopening its border, other discussions, of course, not just within the region, but outside the region as well. So these are all very hopeful. And another thing that's interesting is the wording of Anthony Blinken on his recent announcement that he said, they wouldn't be dropping any sanctions that exist right now against Syria, and he said that they would not be encouraging the renewing of ties with Syria, but that's not very strong language. You know, at least he didn't say we're going to sanction everyone and anyone who does any business with Syria whatsoever. So, you know, I'm hoping that these are all can be taken somewhat at face value. What's going on in Lebanon, of course, confuses the situation a little bit and the games that are being played there. But from what we can tell regarding Syria, I do say I'm fairly optimistic.
That's interesting. So let's also talk to Hafsa about the same question. The U.S., just as Janice just mentioned, has said that it has no plans to normalize or upgrade diplomatic relations with Syria, and it does not encourage others to do so. So do you think, are you as optimistic as Janice is that there might be some kind of shift because there was not a strong language there?
Yes, and I think it doesn't just come from the U.S. I also think you have to bear in mind that at the early stages of this conflict or this war against Syria, there was an attempt to turn it into a sectarian war and to actually rise the Sunni world against Syria. And one of the things that has been very interesting in the past month, we've had declarations from Al-Azhar, which is the main seat of Sunni scholarship, whereby they've sort of issued statements on the importance of brotherly relations between Shia and Sunni. Now, the statement in itself is a very nice statement, but it would have been welcome 10 years ago at the height of sectarian tensions, at the height of the period where you had people from Pakistan, from Indonesia, from Chechnya, actually attempting to come to Syria in order to overthrow what was then viewed as an enemy of the Sunnis across sort of the Muslim Brotherhood circles that were trying to overthrow Assad. So this return of situation within Sunni scholarship circles is very important, because of course this is the kind of discourse that's going to be used by certain Arab leaderships in countries where religion is very, very important to justify, or to rather to explain, the return of normal relations with Syria. So I think all these elements point to the the accepting of Assad's victory, and obviously preparing the next few years to resume business and return to normal, obviously having spent the past 10 years destroying Syria, sadly. But I think, again, it's sort of optimistic to realize that Syrian integrity has remained intact, and I think most Arab countries are now going to resume relations as before with Syria, with Assad as its leader.
Okay, now back to the U.S. So, Janice, do you think, since you're so optimistic, do you believe that Syria and chaos, particularly in Syria, does not serve U.S. interests anymore?
Well, you know, the general perception here, I think, is that the U.S. government has realized the war, which I call the war of terror, has not been all that profitable compared to what a war perhaps against China would be. That's a very cynical take, but not out of the realm of possibility. And therefore, the focus is turning further east and away from creating chaos, destabilization, death, and destruction in the Middle East. You know, we only know what we can see on the surface, the footprints they leave. And does more stability in the Middle East benefit Washington? It certainly would benefit America. It would benefit everyone, particularly, you know, the people in the Middle East who have been through such horrific conflicts. But it, you know, whether or not that is profitable for D.C. remains the question. The pro-Israel lobby is still, of course, very strong. In fact, probably the strongest single entity, the special interest working in D.C. on these issues. They just recently got, I think, 70 pieces of legislation passed in their favor. You know, it certainly Israel will never pursue a stable, you know, they would never want a stable and strong Syria, because Syria is such a leader in the resistance, along with Iran and Hezbollah and other resistance groups. So, you know, I think time will tell, but I believe what I'm seeing, and I really appreciate what your other guest said about the scholars, is that there's a general will to put this behind them in the region. And this is, of course, what we want to see happen, is for the region to determine its own future and destiny, and not the West.
Well, it is true. Peace is something that everyone wants, but unfortunately, this is something on the surface. The U.S. also maintains an occupation force of about 900 soldiers in eastern Syria. It supports terrorist activities in that region. And that is exactly the region where most of the country's oil fields are. So are you still of the same belief, considering this fact, putting that into the picture? I'm asking Janice, and then I would like to have your answer as well, Hafsa.
You know, to say I'm optimistic is just that I'm hoping to be optimistic. It's not really that strong. We know the dirty games go deep and are always among us. The you know, I think the recent Israeli strike looked like it came from over Al-Tamp and hit the base in Syria. So until the U.S. occupying forces leave Syria, where they've been illegally occupying all these years, there's really, the U.S. hasn't put any of their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and it could be all talk at this point. I think that it's true. Syria obviously has been the victor in this war, and it's a question of cleaning up what remains of the problems, but I do believe that's going to take a considerable amount of time.
Well, thank you very much. Now, Hafsa, what is your opinion regarding oil fields?
I think that is alarming, in particular, as it obviously stifles the Syrian economy and obviously slows down the reconstruction process. However, I also think that the U.S. is attempting to save face. I mean, when was the last time the U.S. actually won a war despite its incredible military might? We've just seen very recently that they were forced out with their tails between their legs out of Afghanistan, fighting essentially a ragtag army that was equipped with rusty AK-47s. We know that they were defeated in Vietnam against people who barely had any weapons and who used rice fields and basic booby traps against their helicopter gunships and against their napalm. They still won. I think the last sort of victory that the U.S. can claim is when they invaded the small island of Grenada with 3,000 people and don't even have an army. So I think that what they're trying to do now is to save face and sort of issue all these statements and ensure that they will have some soldiers remain who will gradually leave, a bit as they have been doing in Afghanistan, and just sort of until we, and obviously delete or slightly erase the Syrian issue from the news, and until it's completely forgotten, and until their defeat essentially at the hand of the Syrian army is no longer in the news and is no longer in the memory of American opinion, and realizes that actually once again, despite the $1 trillion that the U.S. spends on its army, it still really can't win any conflicts.
Now, since you mentioned the U.S. failure in Afghanistan, and of course its chaotic withdrawal that we witnessed, do you think that, Hafsa, that has firmed up a belief in the Arab world that they need to chart their own course?
I would love to say yes, but I mean, unfortunately, the recent normalization with many Arab countries, with Israel, has sort of slightly derailed that. Again, I would have to add that opinion on this topic is not on a par with what the leaderships have been doing. If you take Morocco, for instance, there have been a number of protests against the decision, perhaps far more subdued in the Gulf countries, but perhaps also because freedom of opinion is not as easy in those countries. But I mean, I think that those decisions have sort of broken down the idea that there can be a united Arab front against imperialism. And I think we're not going to see that anytime soon, because that is going to happen, until Arab countries pay the price for their normalization with Israel. And they normally do, and this is not some sort of wishful thinking. I'm just remembering, for instance, in 2000, Mauritania actually announced that it was starting relationship with Israel, and the prime minister at the time brought an Israeli Praetorian guard to protect him, and 6 months later he was ousted in a coup. So it's never really worthwhile to actually engage in any relations with Israel, and I think that these countries who have done that are going to start paying the consequences of this normalization. But until that happens, I'm afraid I don't see a sort of united Arab front being created in the immediate future, no.
So, Janice, what is your opinion regarding that?
Well, I agree with your other guest on that. And I would say one key clue in all this is the ongoing support for the Saudi aggression against Yemen. And, you know, Joe Biden had a perfect opportunity when he took office. He had basically a mandate to do that, and he did not do it. And the fighting continues in Yemen. And until that situation is resolved and the U.S. and the U.K. stop their assistance of the Saudis, then I think we have to look at everything with a very cynical and skeptical eye. So, you know, I think your other guest is true. The people of the region, of course, do not want to normalize relations with Israel. And, you know, I think this is, again, why we're seeing the battles or the chaos and violence may be intensifying in Lebanon. You know, and there's also the dimension that there are different parties involved here, even from the U.S. side. The CIA can be doing one thing, the State Department doing something totally different, and the Pentagon doing something totally different. They aren't necessarily all in unity on these things, particularly the CIA, which is quite rogue. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to wait and see, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so Hafsa, the border between Syria and Jordan was fully reopened for trade last month, and Amman has been picked a route to actually pipe Egyptian natural gas to Lebanon via Syria. Do you think this can encourage other countries, Arab countries, to follow suit?
I think we're going to have to wait and see how things evolve. And I agree, the Lebanon issue, which is very, very alarming at the moment, it might distract from any sort of future efforts. But I think that, yes, I think if we can see a return of some form of normality and a return of trade and all the advantages that we can get from these kind of, from the return of stability in the region, then yes, I think everything falls into place. However, if this is followed by chaos in Lebanon, hopefully not obviously, but some sort of civil conflict that will suck all the energy away from these good efforts that have been happening on the Syrian-Jordan front, I think it's going to slow things down. And again, I think at the moment, and this is the problem also with the Arab world, it's almost as if it's whack-a-mole. As soon as one situation one fire is extinguished, you have another one popping up elsewhere, and it sort of distracts all the attention. So, I mean, I'm afraid we have to look at what will be happening in the next few months in Lebanon. But if that manages to sort of scale back, then I think we can expect sort of a next few years and a return of some form of stability and normalization between Arab countries that can be encouraging.
Mm-hmm. And Janice, finally, Washington's decade-long war and all the support of those terrorist groups active in the region did not lead to any kind of regime change. Do you think that the economic warfare could do that?
Well, certainly things are very difficult for most people in Syria. The poverty rate has gone up so dreadfully. 60% of the people were reported to be, you know, near starving. And this, of course, is why they implement these economic siege sanctions, is to get the people to be so miserable that they'll rise up against whatever the government is the U.S. wants to overthrow. But I'm not seeing that. I think even though, you know, a lot of people there want to leave, they're not feeling much hope for the future right at this moment. All of these announcements of reinitializing relations with neighboring countries, etc., do serve to give some hope, I think. And so, no, I'm not sensing that is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And how's that, your opinion?
Absolutely not. If anything, it has the opposite effect. I think when you impose these sort of punitive sanctions, and I think Iran is a good example of that, if anything, you rally your people around your government. And it's the same that happened with Syria. I mean, let's not forget, you did have people who did oppose Assad, but faced with an external aggression, they all rallied against their leadership. And so these kind of sanctions, which have punitive effects on the people, actually prove that you have to rally around your government in order to fight a common enemy. And not just in the Arab world. Remember, in Venezuela, the sanctions were very, very punitive, and the poverty was being felt on a daily basis by people. But that still didn't allow Juan Guaido to take over. And the attempts by Washington to overthrow the Venezuelan president failed miserably. So if anything, I think these, although they're very, very detrimental and they do impact the population and they do cause great misery, which doesn't impact in any way Washington's conscience, they actually have the opposite effect because they tend to rally the population around their leaderships.
Thank you very much, Hafsa and Janice. That's all the time that we have.